In the middle of the 5th century BCE, a ship from Asia Minor cuts across the Aegean, its hull packed with grain, oil, and pottery. Among the passengers stands a man in his early 40s, with the face of someone used to thinking more than talking. He is leaving his home city, Clazomenae, in Ionia, heading toward Athens, which is not yet the cultural capital it will become, but already a restless, ambitious democracy. This man brings with him a different way of thinking about the world, one born on the Ionian coast but sharpened in solitude. A vision in which the cosmos is made not of a single substance, but of infinitely many kinds of stuff, all present everywhere, shaped and ordered by a cosmic mind. His name is Anaxagoras, and he will become, for a brief but intense period, the philosopher of Pericles Athens. Anaxagoras was born around 500 BCE in Clazomenae, a small Ionian city on the western coast of what is now Turkey. Ionia had already produced the pioneering natural philosophers, Thales with his water, Anaximander with his Apeiron, Anaximenes with his air, Heraclitus with his ever-living fire. These men, in different ways, had tried to explain the world's diversity by pointing to a single underlying stuff or principle. Anaxagoras inherited their ambition, but not their simplicity. When he looked at nature, he saw not one thing in many forms, but countless distinct qualities and structures, flesh and bone, blood and bark, gold and stone, hair and leaf. He asked, "Can all of this really be the unfolding of one homogeneous thing? And if not, how can we think of a world in which everything seems to come from everything else without violating Parmenides' injunction that nothing comes from nothing?" Like Empedocles, Anaxagoras took Parmenides seriously. He refused to say that something could arise where nothing of that kind had been before. When a tree grows from a seed, for example, it is not that wood suddenly appears out of nowhere. When a living body forms in the womb from blood and nourishment, it is not that flesh and bone and hair pop into being ex nihilo. There must, he thought, already be in the seed or the blood some presence, however latent, of all those later structures. That conviction pushed him beyond the four root theory of Empedocles. Four basic stuffs, earth, air, fire, water, did not seem enough to account for the richness of the world. So Anaxagoras proposed something more radical. He imagined that in the beginning, everything was mixed with everything. The cosmos was a kind of infinitely rich soup, in which all the ingredients of reality were present in every region, down to the smallest scale. There was no pure earth, no pure fire, no pure anything. Instead, there were indefinitely many seeds or portions, for flesh, for bone, for gold, for hair, for every kind of thing, that were thoroughly interwoven. Nothing was yet distinct. There was, as he put it, a mixture of all things in all things. This idea is often summarized by his phrase, "everything in everything." It sounds paradoxical, but it aims at solving a problem. If you believe that the world is full of many distinct kinds of stuffs, and you accept Parmenides' ban on emergence from nothing, you face a dilemma. Either you say that each thing comes only from its own kind, flesh only from flesh, bone only from bone, and then you cannot explain how the first flesh or bone or blood ever came to be. Or you say that new qualities really do emerge from unlike stuff, and then you seem to be allowing being to arise from non-being. Anaxagoras's answer is subtle. He says that in every piece of matter, however small, all qualities are present in some proportion. When we say something is flesh or bone or wood, we mean only that the seeds of flesh or bone or wood are dominant there. Nothing ever contains only one kind of seed. Nothing is ever entirely devoid of others. There is no absolute empty and no absolute pure. To picture this, imagine a very fine-grained mixture of colored powders, reds, blues, greens, whites, shaken together until every pinch contains at least a trace of each color, though some may be more visible than others. If you scoop up one pinch and see mostly red, you might call it the red pinch, but in truth, there are tiny grains of all the other colors in it as well, just not prominent enough to dominate the appearance. For Anaxagoras, matter is like this at every scale. What looks like a homogeneous piece of bread or stone is actually an unimaginably intricate mixture of infinitely many kinds of seeds. This infinite divisibility is crucial. Anaxagoras insists that there is no smallest part of anything. However small a portion you take, you can always divide it further, and in each portion, there will still be all the different kinds of seeds. Cut a piece of bone in half, and each half still contains seeds of flesh, bone, hair, and more. Cut those halves again, and again the same is true. There is no level at which you reach a pure, unmixed element. Unlike the later atomists, who will imagine tiny indivisible particles of one kind of stuff, Anaxagoras populates the world with endless mixtures. The world is granular, without ever arriving at grains. But if everything is mixed with everything, how do distinct things arise at all? How do we get something we can confidently call blood or stone or air? Here Anaxagoras introduces his second audacious idea, nous, mind. In the primordial state, all seeds are mixed, but not forever. At some point, mind begins to act. Mind is not a seed among others. It is pure, unmixed, and separate. It does not contain portions of everything. It is in itself the finest and purest of things, knowing and ruling all. Anaxagoras says mind is infinite, self-ruled, unmixed with anything, and it initiates motion in the cosmic mixture. Mind, he tells us, began to make things revolve from the beginning, and it set in order all things that were to be, and all that were, and are now, and will be. The image is of a great vortex. Under the impulse of mind, a portion of the primordial mixture starts to rotate, like water swirling in a whirlpool. This rotation spreads, gradually drawing more and more of the mixture into its motion. As it spins, sorting begins. Things that are finer and lighter move outward. Things heavier and denser move inward. Like in a pan where you swirl muddy water and see the heavier sediment sink, while lighter particles rise, the cosmic whirl causes like seeds to cluster together in different regions. Over long stretches of time, this sorting process produces distinct layers and bodies, the fiery, luminous regions we call stars and sun, the airy, misty, enveloping layer we call sky, the dense, opaque mass we call earth. Anaxagoras uses familiar separations as analogies. When we churn milk, cream separates out from whey. When we sieve grain, fine flour is separated from husk. When we wash wool, dirt is separated from fiber. The world, he suggests, has undergone a cosmic churning under the guidance of mind, separating out mixtures into regions where certain seeds dominate. Even now, he thinks, the process is not finished. The cosmos remains in motion, mixing and separating continue. In this picture, there is no creation out of nothing, only a reorganization of what was already there. The seeds do not come into being, they are eternal. The motion, initiated by mind, does not make new substances. It redistributes and concentrates them. When the earth forms, it is not because earth stuff suddenly appears, but because seeds of earth that were already everywhere are gathered more densely in one region. When living creatures arise, they do so from the earth and the mixture of elements under the ongoing action of heat, cold, and the cosmic swirl. Anaxagoras was particularly interested in explaining natural phenomena that others had attributed to gods. Eclipses, for instance, had long been seen as ominous interventions by divine powers. Anaxagoras proposed instead that the sun is a fiery stone larger than the Peloponnesus, and that eclipses occur when the moon passes in front of it. The moon, he thought, is an earthy body that shines by reflecting the light of the sun. When it moves into the earth's shadow, we see a lunar eclipse. These claims were startlingly bold for his time. To say that the sun and moon are stones, that their movements are regular, that eclipses are predictable geometrical events, was to strip these lights of their divine personality and reframe them as parts of a natural machine. He also offered explanations for meteors, comets, and the Milky Way, treating them as physical phenomena rather than omens. When a large meteorite fell near the town of Aegospotami, a blazing rock from the sky, Anaxagoras took it as confirmation that heavenly bodies are indeed rocky and not ethereal gods. The heavens, on his view, are not a separate, incorruptible realm, but made of the same stuff as Earth, differing only in mixture and motion. Perhaps his most famous and controversial claim, though, involves living things. Anaxagoras believed that animals and plants develop from seeds that are already present in the environment. In one fragment, he suggests that when the earth was originally warmed and moistened, seeds of living things were carried down by rain and sprouted. More provocatively, he seems to have thought that there are seeds of all things in the food we eat, and that bodies grow by extracting like from like. When you eat bread, he would say, you are not turning bread into flesh by some magical transformation. You are drawing out the seeds of flesh that were already in the bread, organizing them under the guidance of your body's own structure. The bread contained seeds of bone, flesh, hair, blood, and much more. But your body's processes concentrate certain ones and let others pass through. This way of thinking has a strange, almost modern flavor. It is not, of course, molecular biology or chemistry. Anaxagoras does not know about proteins, fats, and carbohydrates. He does not know about DNA or cells. But he knows that there must be some continuity between what we ingest and what we become. His seeds of all things are an attempt to think through how nourishment can give rise to structure without the structure coming from nowhere. The presence of mind in his system is equally significant. While earlier Ionians had spoken of archai, water, air, the Apeiron, as underlying reality, they had not clearly articulated a separate, organizing intelligence. Heraclitus had hinted at logos, a rational principle that orders all. Anaxagoras gives that principle a name and a place, nous. Unlike the seeds, nous is not mixed. It is pure, unmoved, yet it moves others. It knows all and governs all. Human beings, he suggests, participate in mind. Our own thinking is a fragment or expression of cosmic nous, even though our bodies are composed of thoroughly mixed seeds, where the mixture is especially fine and balanced. Mind can act with more clarity. This is why, he says, where the other things are in great number, mind is present in none of them. Only in living beings with appropriately structured bodies can mind be fully at work. In Athens, these ideas landed in a politically and culturally charged environment. Anaxagoras found patronage and friendship with Pericles, the leading statesman of the city. Pericles was building Athens into a great imperial democracy, with its monumental Parthenon, its festivals, its dramas, its navy. He surrounded himself with artists, thinkers, and rhetoricians. Anaxagoras, with his rational cosmology and sharp intellect, fit into this circle. Later writers say that Pericles' famous calm and self-control, his Olympian demeanor, were due in part to Anaxagoras's influence. The philosopher, they say, taught him to see human fortunes under the aspect of cosmic necessity, to regard setbacks as transient events in a larger ordered whole. But Athens was also a city where traditional religious feeling ran deep, and where political enemies were always ready to use impiety charges as weapons. Anaxagoras's claims about the sun and moon, that the sun is a red-hot stone and the moon an earthy body, were easily framed as blasphemous. If the sun is a stone, what room is left for Helios, the sun god? If the moon is just earth, what becomes of Selene's divinity? To demythologize the heavens was to risk being seen as undermining the gods. Eventually, Anaxagoras was accused of impiety. The details are murky. Some say his enemies targeted him in order to get at Pericles. Others say there was genuine outrage at his teachings. In any case, he was tried. Accounts differ about the outcome. Perhaps Pericles secured his exile instead of execution. Anaxagoras left Athens and spent his remaining years in Lampsacus, a city on the Hellespont, where he continued to teach and think. The people of Lampsacus reportedly honored him, and after his death, they remembered him with an annual festival for children. The image of Anaxagoras in old age, living quietly in exile, is poignant. Here is a man who had tried to replace fear and superstition with understanding, who had offered rational accounts of eclipses and meteors and nourishment and generation, and he is driven out of the city that had once celebrated him. His mind, which he had posited as the ordering principle of the cosmos, could not protect him from the disorder of politics. Yet, there is a kind of moral consistency in his reaction. When told that his son had died, one anecdote has him reply simply, "I knew that I had begotten a mortal." It is the same intellectual acceptance he had taught Pericles. Human beings are finite mixtures in a vast, ordered whole. To be mortal is to be subject to change and loss. For the history of philosophy, Anaxagoras's two major ideas, the everything in everything mixture of seeds and the cosmic mind, resonate in different ways. The seeds give him a way to preserve the Eleatic prohibition on creation from nothing, while explaining the apparent emergence of new qualities. The mind allows him to reject the notion that blind necessity alone governs the world. Later thinkers will pick up both threads. Plato, in particular, was fascinated and disappointed by Anaxagoras. In one dialogue, Socrates recounts his own intellectual development, saying that when he first heard that Anaxagoras posited mind as the cause of all things, he was thrilled. Surely, Socrates thought, this meant that Anaxagoras would explain why everything is arranged for the best, why the cosmos is structured according to what is good and just. But when he read Anaxagoras' book, he found that the philosopher often appealed to mind only as a kind of first mover, and then explained specific phenomena in terms of material causes, air, ether, water, and so on. In other words, mind did not play the robust teleological role Socrates had hoped for. It started the cosmic whirl and knew the whole, but Anaxagoras did not systematically derive the particular order of things from minds aiming at the good. Still, the very idea that the cosmos could be understood as the work of a rational mind left a mark. Plato's own demiurge in the Timaeus, a craftsman god who shapes the world according to intelligible forms, is in some ways a development of Anaxagoras's nous. Aristotle, too, in his Metaphysics, acknowledges that Anaxagoras stood out like a sober man among drunkards by introducing mind as a cause, though he faults him for not using it consistently. The mixture doctrine, for its part, raised deep questions about the nature of matter and quality. If everything is in everything, then what we call this thing or that thing is just a provisional label for a region where certain qualities are dominant. There are no absolutely simple bodies, no perfectly homogeneous chunks of stuff. Identity is always a matter of degree and proportion. This way of thinking anticipates, in a far-off way, the idea that what we see as distinct substances are configurations of underlying structures that are, at base, continuous. Modern physics, with its quantum fields and overlapping probability distributions, looks at times more Anaxagorean than Democritean. From an ethical angle, Anaxagoras does not offer detailed prescriptions. He does not write, as later philosophers will, about virtue, justice, or the best political arrangement in a systematic way. But his cosmology carries moral implications. One is the dethroning of fear. If eclipses, comets, and meteorites are not portents of divine anger but natural events, then anxiety about them can give way to curiosity. A mind attuned to nous will seek understanding rather than propitiation. The world remains awesome, but its awe is intellectual and aesthetic, not terror before arbitrary powers. Another implication is the elevation of intellect. Since mind is the ordering principle of the whole cosmos, and since human beings participate in mind through their capacity to reason, our highest calling is to exercise that capacity. To live well in an Anaxagorean mood is to live in a way that aligns with the rational structure of the world. To accept mortality, to refrain from panic at natural events, to value understanding over ritual correctness. In this, Anaxagoras anticipates the later Stoic ideal of living according to nature, where nature is understood as a rational, ordered whole. His fate in Athens also serves as an early example of a recurring tension in Western moral thought. A clash between rational inquiry and established norms. Philosophers who question traditional images of the gods, who offer alternative accounts of the heavens, often find themselves accused of corrupting the youth or undermining piety. Anaxagoras' trial foreshadows those of Socrates, and much later, of thinkers tried by religious authorities for heresy. The moral question becomes, what do we owe to truth when it threatens to disturb the comfort of our community? Anaxagoras' life suggests an answer. We owe it loyalty, even at personal cost. In a classroom or a podcast, he can be presented as a calm, almost severe figure, someone who looks at fire in the sky and sees not a god hurling omens, but a stone reflecting sunlight, who looks at birth and growth and sees not a miracle ex nihilo, but the rearrangement of invisible seeds. There is a kind of moral seriousness in that posture. It refuses to flatter our desire for specialness. It also refuses to leave us at the mercy of fear. The world under Anaxagoras' gaze is not centered on us, but it is intelligible, and we as thinking beings are a part of that intelligibility. The very phrase everything and everything has ethical overtones when heard metaphorically. It suggests that in each of us, there are traces of many possibilities, many tendencies, not only what is dominant and visible, just as a piece of bread contains seeds of many things. So a person might contain, in potential, capacities for kindness, cruelty, insight, blindness, courage, cowardice. Which ones become prominent depends on the patterns of our lives, the mixture produced by habit, education, and choice. To become better is not to import goodness from outside, as if it were utterly foreign, but to cultivate what is already latent within the mixture. Anaxagoras himself, in exile, contemplating the sky from Lampsacus, may have felt both the indifference and the comfort of the cosmic order he had described. The same mind that set the heavens in motion had not intervened to save him from trial, but it had given him, and those like him, the capacity to understand. That gift is, in his worldview, the most divine thing about us. To exercise it is to participate, however briefly, in the cosmic nous, to see the world, if only faintly, as mind sees it. Later, when atomists like Leucippus and Democritus arrived on the scene, they would push back against Anaxagoras's infinite mixtures with an opposite kind of boldness. Instead of everything and everything, they posited tiny, indivisible atoms of a few basic shapes and sizes, moving in the void. Where Anaxagoras saw continuity and infinite divisibility, they saw discreteness and empty space. Where he filled every region with all kinds of seeds, they left vast stretches of nothingness between solid particles. Their world has a certain clarity and economy that his lacks, but it loses something too. The sense that every portion of matter, however small, is pregnant with all forms, that the richness of the world is somehow folded into each of its parts. From the standpoint of moral and religious imagination, the Anaxagorean vision can be strangely consoling. If there is no absolute void, if no portion of the world is ever completely barren, then perhaps no life is either. However desolate a situation may seem, some seeds of other possibilities remain present, even if they are not dominant. Change on this view is always a reconfiguration, a bringing to the front of what was already faintly there. Even death, terrible as it is, becomes not an annihilation into nothing, but a dissolution of one mixture into others, the seeds of a body returning to the wider swirl of the world. Later theologians and philosophers in the Greek and Roman worlds would occasionally look back to Anaxagoras with a kind of backward respect. His nous, though not yet a creator god in the full sense, looked to them like a first step toward conceiving a divine intellect ordering all things. Early Christian writers, eager to show that pagans had glimpsed fragments of truth, sometimes pointed to him as someone who suspected that mind was behind the cosmos. Neoplatonists, for their part, could assimilate his nous into their hierarchies of intellects. In this way, a thinker who had been prosecuted for impiety in Athens became, in retrospect, an unwitting forerunner of more explicitly religious metaphysics. At the same time, his insistence on explaining as much as possible in terms of natural causes lived on in more secular strands of thought. Whenever a philosopher or scientist rejects superstition and looks for underlying mechanisms, when eclipses are traced to orbital mechanics, diseases to pathogens rather than curses, mental states to brain processes rather than demonic possession, there is a distant echo of Anaxagoras telling Athenians that the sun is a stone and the moon is earth. The ethical stance behind that move is a commitment to honesty about what we find, even when it disappoints our love of drama. It is not hard to imagine Anaxagoras today, transported into our world, standing under a city sky washed pale by electric light, watching a partial solar eclipse with the certainty of someone who knows in advance how the shadow will move. He would likely marvel at our instruments, at telescopes and particle accelerators, at images of galaxies we have captured. But he would recognize in the basic attitude of inquiry something very old, the refusal to be cowed by spectacle, the desire to understand rather than to worship what we do not yet grasp. And if he listened in on our ethical debates about how to balance tradition and discovery, how to live under a sky that no longer seems populated by watchful gods, he might feel again the tension he felt in Athens. He knew what it was to belong to a culture with powerful inherited stories about the gods, and yet to see, with his own mind, that the world followed patterns that those stories did not capture. He paid a price for speaking that truth. But in doing so, he helped carve out a space in which later generations could think more freely, not only about the physical world, but about what it means to live honestly within it. For a listener following the arc of Western moral philosophy, Anaxagoras may seem like a transitional figure, a man more interested in the heavens than in the heart. Yet his work changes the air that later moral thinkers breathe. It pushes the gods upward, away from immediate meteorological and astronomical phenomena, and leaves the world increasingly open to rational scrutiny. In that newly opened space, questions of justice, virtue, and the good life will be posed in a different key. If thunder and eclipse are no longer messages from Zeus, then we must look elsewhere for guidance. If mind orders the whole, but does not constantly tinker with every event, then perhaps our task is not to guess the whims of deities, but to align our finite understanding with the larger rational order. Seen in that way, Anaxagoras is not just a cosmologist, but an ancestor of a certain moral temperament, clear-eyed, accepting of necessity, resistant to fear, quietly devoted to understanding. His life, marked by exile and loss, shows that such a temperament does not guarantee worldly success, but it does offer a kind of dignity. The dignity of someone who, having once glimpsed the world as the work of mind, refuses to pretend it is anything else.
Midnight rails under silver moon, dusty boots on a winding road. A shadow's the only friend I've known since she packed up and let me go. Empty whiskey bottle on the sea, her laugh still echoes in my bones. Saddle's heavy with memories. I ride alone where the wind still blows. Nowhere else to be. Nowhere else to be. Nowhere else to be. The horizon gold, but it don't warm a lonesome soul. Every town I pass feels half her size. Every trail's haunted by goodbye. I whisper prayers to open skies, hoping someday my heart'll find
brand new path beyond the pain where broken hearts can heal in time. Nowhere else to be. Nowhere else to be. Nowhere else to be. Nowhere else to be. Nowhere else to be.
Nowhere else to be.